Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Back in 2012, I had the privilege to sit down with legendary football manager Tommy Docherty for TalkSport's My Sporting Life series. Tommy made his name as a player, most notably with Preston North End, where he made over 300 appearances, as well as representing Arsenal and Celtic in those playing days. He also won international honours with Scotland, captaining his country, as well as being a member of the squads that went to both the 1954 and 1958 World Cups. But it's his 28-year career as a manager that most people remember with a special fondness. In particular, his spells in charge of Chelsea and Manchester United, where he built young, exciting, vibrant sides that both went on to win major honours. Thomas Henderson Docherty was born on the 24th of August in 1928 in the Gorbals in Glasgow. I started our interview by asking about his upbringing in that infamous location.
Yes, it was rough, but no different, I don't think, from the East End of London or the East End of most cities. At the end of the day, it's not the place, it's the people that actually matter. And the East End of Glasgow, the Gorbals, was a fantastic place because you knew nothing else. I mean, little things like if you wanted a new pair of shoes, you went to the swimming baths on Saturday morning. Nicked a pair. As soon as the fella blew the whistle and opened the door, you're going to get a new pair of shoes and whatever, or a better pair than you already had. Yes, it was rough, but it was no different. You didn't think you were. You thought you were well off because up in the morning, some porridge for your breakfast, anything that was going for your lunch or your dinner, and you just took what was going. And I think everyone was in the same boat.
I mean, your dad Thomas died when you were nine, leaving your mum Georgina and yourself and sisters Margaret and Sally. I mean, the poverty and the difficult circumstances, as you say, was the same for everyone. But to all of that was added at a very young age for you when you were 11. The Second World War broke out. What are your memories of that?
My memories of the Second World War were when we got evacuated from Glasgow and we went to a place called Stirling.
Right.
And we went on a Sunday and we came home on the Monday.
That wasn't very good.
No, well, my mother said if we're going to get bombed, we'll get bombed in our own house in Glasgow, not in Stirlingshire. And where she got the money from, I don't know, but she got a taxi and took us back home to where we'd left the day before. And we stayed there until during the war and well after the war, actually.
I mean, we're well aware of, you know, because we see endless documentaries about it, about what the population of London went through during the war. What was it like in Glasgow? I mean, as a young teenager, did you actually live pretty much normally or was it not like that?
You just got on with it, actually. It was as simple as that, actually, because everyone was in the same boat. You had your gas mask, which you took to school with you, periods of the day you had to get it out and put it on just as a preliminary measure. So when anything, God forbid, did happen, you knew how to get it on as quickly as you possibly could. But everyone seemed to be in the same boat, and of course the bombing of the Clydebank shipyards, which was quite near us as well, which was dreadful, actually. But you just got on with it. It was as simple as that, actually. And of course I left school at special dispensation. I left school at 12 years of age. And I got a job delivering groceries in the afternoons.
And why were you allowed to leave school at 12?
Because my mother was a widow.
Uh-huh.
And she got a special dispensation where I could go out and earn a few shillings more than a widow then.
I take it that with the Irish connection in your family, that you were a supporter of Glasgow Celtic.
Yeah, well, I was born, you know, it was a situation where if you were a Catholic boy,
yeah,
you supported Glasgow Celtic. if you're a Protestant lad or a non-Catholic lad, you supported Glasgow Rangers. And that was the situation in Glasgow at the time. And it always has, always was, but not now, of course.
Did you get to see the Celtic team of the time?
Well, I used to get out of school on if they were playing midweek Wednesday occasionally. And we used to go to school at 3 o'clock, run down to Parkhead, Paradise, as we called it, mm-hmm. Celtic Park. They opened the gates 20 minutes from the end to let people out. And when they let those people out, we ran in and got the last 20 minutes. And they were my boyhood heroes.
Absolutely. And this is going to be incredible to people listening to your voice now, Tommy. And I must say, thank you very much. You are, with all due respect, the oldest person who's done My Sporting Life for us. And so we're talking about things that people will no longer even recognise. For instance, suddenly, after the Second World War ended, you're in your late teens, you're a talented footballer, and you have to do national service, and you join the army for 2 years.
Well, I didn't join the army. I didn't have a choice, actually.
The army joined you, didn't it?
That's right. And I had a choice of being a Bevan boy, because at the time I was working for Beattie's Bakery, driving a horse and delivering bread to the various shops. And ironical enough, over in Copeland Road at Ibrox Park, where Rangers Ground is, I used to deliver the bread to the shops in there and all over Glasgow. And they were fantastic times, actually. And, of course, always being a Glasgow Celtic lad as well, from since I can remember, actually. It was fantastic and great days.
You joined the Highland Light Infantry, if I got that right. And, in fact, you served your national service, not just lounging around on your backside here and there, but you actually went to Palestine as the fighting was starting.
Yeah, well, what happened, actually, as I said, I had the choice of being a Bevan boy or in the army, and I thought, there's no way I'm going down the pit. So I was called up. I didn't join it. I was conscripted into the army. And I did 6 weeks at Whittington Barracks in Lichfield there. And after 6 weeks there, I was posted to Redford Barracks in Edinburgh, where I did the 3 months in Edinburgh with HLI, Highland Light Infantry. And we got a call one morning about 2 a.m. and into trucks, drove all the way to Southampton. Next thing we knew, we were on a ship and we were heading for Palestine.
And again, in Palestine, the issues that were to lead and the conflict that was to lead to the foundation of the State of Israel was in full swing.
Yeah.
One of the most famous incidents was when the giant hotel, the King David, in Jerusalem was bombed. Nearly 100 people killed in July of 1946. You were there.
Yeah, fortunately for me, as I say, I was in the right side of the hotel when it was blown up, and thank God we were okay, but we lost some nice lads, actually, that particular time.
I mean, how close were you to being killed, Tommy, do you think?
Who knows? 5 minutes, maybe 500 yards.
I'm Danny Kelly, this is Talk Sport, and you're listening to a special edition of My Sporting Life, featuring former Chelsea, Manchester United and Scotland manager Tommy Doherty. By July of 1948, you had completed your national service and shortly after joined boyhood hero Celtic. Explain how that came about.
At the time in Palestine, one of our officers out there was a fellow called Adam Little, Glasgow Rangers midfield player, a wing half. And he was a medical man out there, and a lovely, lovely person, actually. And I played for the battalion team, the first Div in Palestine. And that's all I did. I did very little army work, really. I was playing football and sports and running all the time. And he recommended me to Glasgow Celtic.
And I understand that when you got home, there were a variety of people after you wanting to sign you. Burnley, Everton, Manchester United, but obviously as a Celtic fan, there was no choice for you, was it? It had to be Parkhead.
Oh, it was a no-brainer. Yes, it's definitely Celtic Park. You know, paradise. Hail the boys! Actually,
what kind of a club was Celtic in those days? Because I think they'd gone a long time since they'd won anything, hadn't they?
Yeah, I think the last thing they won was the Empire Exhibition Cup in 1939, when Johnny Crump scored the goal, and the team that day was Kenny Mahogan Morris and Geaton's Lions and Patterson, Delaney McDonald, Crumb Divers and Murphy. Great side, and that's, I can remember that.
And so you joined Celtic, you make your first team debut, hooray, in August of 48 against Glasgow Rangers. What do you remember of the pride of joining and playing against Rangers in your first big game?
Well, I played at Aberdeen on a Friday night for the reserves at Pittodrie. And, of course, there was an injury or an illness or something. And I was asked to play outside right for Celtic at Ibrox Park, Glasgow. And of course, I was just coming back from Palace, and they thought the beautiful tan and whatnot, they thought I'd come from somewhere else, actually. And I got a bit of abuse that day from the Rangers supporters, as you always did, and vice versa. The Celtic supporters gave them a lot of abuse as well. But it was a bit of a shock to play in a position I'd never played in my life, actually, outside right.
Having joined your boyhood club, it didn't really work out insofar as that within a year and a bit, you were on your way. November 1949 was a big time for you. You set to set a date to get married with a girl you'd met called Agnes. And as importantly, I guess you'd have to say, you leave Glasgow Celtic for Preston North End. Why was that? How did that come about?
Well, it was a strange situation because those particular days with the home internationals, Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales, and we had a wonderful player called Bobby Evans, a red-headed lad, playing midfield in my position, or I played in his position, whichever way you want to look at it.
At Celtic, yeah.
Yeah, Celtic. And, of course, the game, the internationals were played on a Saturday, so the league programme still went on. And when Bobby was playing for Scotland, I got my opportunity to play for Glasgow Celtic. And that's the reason I played only three games that year, because the home internationals was three matches. Bobby played, and then while he was playing with me, I played for Celtic. And, of course, I didn't really get the opportunity. And all of a sudden, I was playing at Greenock Morton at Capello, and I got spotted by James Taylor, the president of Preston North End. And he signed me for £3,000 from Glasgow Celtic. And the only reason I went was I was about to get married, and they were giving me a clubhouse with a rent of 25 shillings a week.
Yeah, so you actually do get married to Agnes, and you're brought into Preston to replace Bill Shankly, no less. And you make your Preston debut after spending a few days in the reserves to get acclimatised to English football. You make your debut on Christmas Eve in 1949, at Elland Road, Leeds. What kind of club was Preston when you got there?
I don't know. I never even heard of Tom Finney when I got there, believe it or not.
Really?
I just got told I was being transferred and there was nothing I could do about it. Those were the days when you couldn't leave the club, but the club could get rid of you or sell you on if you wanted to. And the fee was £3,000. And I did well. I got about £250 out of that, which was a lot of money in those days, actually. And the next thing I knew, I arrived at Preston, and fortunately for me, the trainer was a Scots gentleman called Jimmy Millen. He's Gordon's father. He was a trainer, and he was a terrific fellow, and he helped us a tremendous amount. And introduced me to Tom Finney, who is now Sir Tom.
What's amazing, of course, is that in those days, a team could come out of the second layer of English football and very quickly establish itself as a top power. As I say, you were promoted in 1951, and then just 2 years later, in one of the closest league title races of all time, you were runners-up to Arsenal, but it really was extraordinarily close, wasn't it?
Point nothing, they never goal.
I mean, I should explain to the teenagers listening that it's not what this is before goal difference. It was goal average, where
you
divided your goals scored by your goals against. You and Arsenal finished level on points, and so they had got a couple of extra goals somewhere along the line.
Again, Burnley at Highbury.
And tell me about that season and what it felt to be so close to winning the title, Tommy.
Well, you didn't think about all you thought about was winning each game rather than winning the title, and you knew that if you won each game, you were going to be there or thereabouts. And you were in the next top division, and we had a good side, and we played tremendous football. We played, with the exception of Sir Tom Finney, we played tiki-taki football, two-touch football, and no matter where we went, it was a mixture of Scottish players and English players and one or two Irish players. We were very, very attractive and great to watch.
Do you look back now with any regret at not having got those couple of extra goals that would have given you the title?
Well, being a midfield player, and then you didn't think about that because the manager we had at Preston at the time called Cliff Britton, he was very defensive-minded, and if you crossed the halfway line, he said, your job is to stop the opposition from playing, not you creating stuff for us. Leave that to Tom Finney. And the amazing thing about me was he said to me twice, and I told him he got lost, actually. He said, if Tom Finney had trained harder, he'd been a better player. I couldn't believe it, you know.
Well, from what I've heard, because I never saw the great man play, he could hardly have been a better player, so it doesn't seem very likely.
Maybe Messi.
Maybe you think as good as Messi.
Messi's as good as him.
Oh, right. Okay, good. In total, you played 9 years at Preston North End, over 325 games for them. Why did you eventually decide to leave, Tommy?
Well, I didn't decide to leave. What happened was I always wanted, believe it or not, when I finished playing football, I wanted to have our own and use agents and tobacco in the shop. And there was one for sale opposite Deepdale, right opposite the ground.
Right.
And it was going for about 400 quid. And that was due, I was in my last year I was 10 years, coming up for 10 years at Preston.
Yeah.
And I was due a benefit in those days.
A testimonial, yeah.
They called it a testimonial, but it was a benefit.
Yes.
And you got £1,000 after 10 years for being, if the opinion of the directors, you were a loyal player and loyal servant. And I asked for a loan of £300 to buy the shop across from Deepdale to make sure when I finished playing, things would be okay. And the manager was a bit dogmatic and he says, no, the board won't allow it there. We didn't even put it to the board. So I said, well, if you think that highly of me, there's no point in hanging about here much longer. So I asked for a transfer and it was granted.
I'm Danny Kelly, this is Talk Sport, and you're listening to a special edition of My Sporting Life, featuring former Chelsea, Manchester United and Scotland manager Tommy Docherty. During Tommy's playing career, he got 25 caps for Scotland. I asked him if he felt he should have got more.
No, not particularly. I probably get picked sometimes when I shouldn't have done, when I wasn't probably playing particularly well for my club, because in those days, they didn't have a manager. They had, they called them selectors.
Right.
And I was playing for Preston, as you said, 10 years. And they used to come down on a Friday night, stay in a hotel with his wife, and they had a nice weekend out of it, and go back with a report on my performance, good, bad, or indifferent. And when they picked a team, they didn't have a manager, as I said, the selectors picked a team, and you would get the paper on the following Thursday, and you could tell by the newspaper whether you were selected for Scotland or not. You didn't get a letter of notification.
You had to look up the squad in the newspapers.
And then at the end you get a notification about a week later, yeah.
And if it didn't have a manager, who decided how the team would play? Who gave the team talk at half-time? What happened?
The trainer.
Uh-huh.
A gentleman called Dawson Walker, who used to be the physiotherapist for Clyde Football Club.
But I think despite the lack of that level of organisation, I think Scotland had a pretty good team at that time in the 50s. Is that right? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, but we didn't have a good team with some good players.
By which you mean?
There was no organisation because we didn't have a manager.
And so you just turn up and hope for the best.
And the thing was, you know, when you were selected and you got the letter from the Football Association, which was the SFA, you got a letter from them saying you've been selected to represent your country against Uruguay or Brazil, and report for training on Monday morning at SFA Park Gardens, and bring a towel and your training kit and soap.
Bring
and
a towel.
Bring a towel and soap and your training kit. Yeah. True. Yeah.
I'm listening to you. You'll forgive me. It's just very hard to believe now.
Well, we're Scots, aren't we? We watch our pennies. So would you bring our own training kit, a towel, and soap?
We all know that the rivalry between England and Scotland, which is a shame that it's been allowed to peter out, really, because of the lack of the home internationals. How intense was that rivalry at football in the 50s?
Ah, terrific. I mean, I think the home internationals were fantastic because it kept everyone going, actually. And if you played at Wembley for Scotland again, England at Wembley, after the game, the supporters used to save up their spare cash for 2 years' time when the game would be played at Hampden. So, you know, it was a case of having a little bank book, and after the game, you maybe put a shilling or two bob in the Monday morning, or when your job was finished on the Friday and you got your pay, they call it the Wembley money or the Hampden money, and you should save up to pay for the trip during the end of season.
I don't think you played in the famous 9-1 defeat at Wembley, did you?
No, I played in the 7-2. I scored that day against England that day, actually. But no, I never played in the other one with Frank Haffey. Final.
Oh.
Somebody said, what time is it? I said, 7 past Haffey.
It was 7, not 9. Starting to exaggerate. You made your debut for Scotland against Wales in 1951 at Hampden. Didn't play for another couple of years. And it looked like your international career might be drifting away in 1953 and 54. And you didn't play much in 53-54. And suddenly, Scotland qualifies for the 54 World Cup. In Switzerland, a very famous World Cup, of course. And you are in the squad. Tell us about your time in that tournament in Switzerland.
Well, I didn't get selected because 54, I broke my leg.
Aha, that'll be it then.
And I was out for about 12 weeks. And I got back again and got fit. And we still didn't have a manager, by the way.
Oh, God.
And anyway, 54 World Cup, we played... I'm telling a lie. Andrew Beattie, ex-Huddersfield Town, was the manager.
Right.
But when we got out to Switzerland,
yes,
he had a meeting with the powers that be, the selectors, and they had a bit of a row over something. And Andy walked out, so Dawson Walker, the Clyde trainer, took over as manager of the team.
I mean, it was a strangely organised tournament.
Dawson was a sponge man. He was a physio gentleman. Nice man, but he knew nothing about football, and he was put in charge of the playing side of the club.
Which might explain why you only played two games, a 1-0 defeat to Austria in Zurich, and in Bern, a few days later, a 7-0 defeat to Uruguay.
And we were lucky to get nil.
Yeah, and was it really 7-0, or could it have been more?
We got away quite lightly, actually. Okay. I thought that had been the score in the first half, never mind the second. And I was asked to mark a fella called Schiofino, who was probably like Suarez is today at Liverpool. And the trainer, who knew nothing about football, said to me, everywhere he goes, go with him. He goes to the bathroom, go with him. If you nullify him, we can get a result today in this match, Tommy. And anyway, he scored 3 goals.
Job done.
No, he's got supposed to be doing my job. Anyway, he scored a hat-trick, and at half-time, the trainer got hold of me. He said, what did I tell you? And the veins were sticking out the side of his neck. He was giving me a right going over. And they said, I said, well, I'm doing my best. I says, every time I get near him, everyone's shaking hands with him and patting him on the back. 7-0, Dan. I tell you what, when the Uruguayan national anthem was finished, we were all shattered because it was so warm and bald that day in Switzerland.
Well, that was 54, and the time moves on, and the next World Cup you're playing is another very famous World Cup, 58 in Sweden.
Yeah.
Scotland don't do so well. You didn't play in the first game, which was a draw. Then they lost to, that was against Yugoslavia, then they lost to Paraguay and France, and which meant that Scotland had gone out. But the players were then given tickets, and you kind of stayed and watched the rest of the tournament as a fan, yeah?
Yeah, that's right.
Which because it was an amazing tournament for Great Britain, because all four of the sides from these islands were in the finals. England went out of the group stages, as did Scotland. Wales and Northern Ireland reached the quarterfinals, and you watched the emergence of a 17-year-old called Pelé.
That's right. But also that particular time, Wales went to the semi-finals.
Right.
I think it was. John Charles, Ivor Oakchurch, people like that. And the coach was a gentleman called Jimmy Murphy, God rest his soul, who I later caught up with at Old Trafford, who took over some Samat after the Munich air crash. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man and never got half the credit that he should have done for the job that he did at Old Trafford. Lovely, lovely man. And he did a great job for Wales and did some great players.
I mean, and as I say, Brazil won the final, I think, 5-2 against the host Sweden with the 17-year-old Pelé. I mean, had you ever seen a player like him before? Did you know he was going to become the player that many people believe to be the greatest ever to lace up boots?
No, not particularly. Not at that. Not at 17 years.
No, you couldn't see that. No,
you couldn't foresee that at all. But he justified everything they said about him, actually, because I've always said, and to this day, Finney's the best player I've ever seen.
Well, I mean, of course, you played with him, and so you're in a position to judge, aren't you?
And a bit biased, of course, I might add as well, but Sir Tom was a different class, actually. But Pelé was like the Messi of today. You can only talk about the present time.
Yes.
And Pelé was like the Messi of today. There's some great players in Brazil.
And that was towards the end of your Scotland career. You played a few more games, including your last game, which I think was a 1-0 defeat to England in April of 59. But by the time we talked about you'd left Preston North End and gone to Arsenal.
That's right.
What kind of club was Arsenal in those days, Tom?
Well, I was doing my coaching badge in the latter year at Preston North End because I had plans, if I could, I'd like to stay in the game in the coaching capacity.
Right.
And Ron Greenwood, God rest his soul, was fantastic to me. He helped me tremendously to get through my coaching badge and the way that he felt the game should be played. And he was a wonderful coach, Ron. And I was at Lillishaw, and he said to me, he chatted me up, actually. He says, do you fancy coming to Arsenal? I said, cool, not half. Because after the way I'd been treated with Preston, with the testimonial, I felt a bit soured, actually. Maybe wrongly. And anyway, before you could see Jack Robson, Arsenal offered £50,000 for me.
and you were there, and you. This is called coming towards the end of your playing career, and you mentioned there about learning to coach and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So during your 3 years at Arsenal, where you make nearly 100 appearances for the club, were you always thinking about one day I'd like to be what you eventually become most remembered for, about coaching a manager?
Yeah, very much so. Ron Greenwood, as I said, even he was a staff coach at Lillishaw, and when, of course, we got transferred to Arsenal, he was very instrumental in shading my ways now the game should be played and how the coaching side of the game should be carried out. And it was absolutely incredible help to me.
And so at the end of that, in February 1961, as I say, 3 years at Arsenal, you know, I can't ask you how they got on, because at those days, it's hard to remember now, they were kind of a mid-table club at the Arsenal.
Yeah, we went, probably our best was about fourth. We went to about fourth, I think, in the league, actually.
And then you got an opportunity to go to Chelsea as a player coach, under Ted Drake.
Yeah.
And that was something you couldn't pass up, because you knew it was time for you to start looking after the team rather than just be part of the team.
Yeah, that's true. It was an amazing situation, actually, because Ron Greenwood told me that Chelsea were looking for a coach and would have interest. I said, yes, I would be, actually, when I finished playing. And Joe Mears was the Chelsea chairman at the time, who was also chairman of the Football Association.
Right.
So he asked me to go over for an interview on the coaching side of the club. And then in the boardroom, and the four directors were sitting there with Mr. Mears. And Mr. Mears said to me, Tommy, I know nothing about football, although I am chairman of the Football Association. And my four colleagues here know a damn sight less than I do. I thought, I've got a chance here. And Ted Drake said I wasn't his choice as coach for Chelsea. So I said, well,
that's not very helpful, is it?
No, well, it wasn't very encouraging, no. But anyway, to cut a long story short, I was appointed first-team coach at Stamford Bridge for Chelsea by Mr. Joe Mears over Mr. Drake's head, I might add. Yeah.
Well, we'll hear about that conflict in just a little while, because it is the start of a journey as a club manager that, as I says, has left you with a legendary and indelible mark in the English game. Next here on TalkSport, we're on My Sporting Life, we'll be looking at your days at Stamford Bridge, where you succeed Ted Drake as manager and go on to build a really exciting side that Chelsea fans remember with extraordinary affection, and goes on to challenge for the major honours in the English game. You're listening to My Sporting Life. My guest tonight is the unforgettable and the one and only Tommy Docherty.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to a special My Sporting Life from 2012 with legendary football manager Tommy Docherty. Now, we've heard about Tommy's playing days at Celtic, Preston and Arsenal. In this next part of the show, we discuss the beginning of Tommy's managerial career at Chelsea, first as assistant, then taking over from Ted Drake in February of 1962. I asked him how he found the club when he arrived in the early 60s.
Good club, very good club actually, but the team itself was loaded with players who were good players for the club, some great players for the club, but were past their sell-by date. And of course, they had to be moved on, and that is never a popular decision to make or even to do. And I felt it was the older players were dominating the young players. And of course, as long as that was going to continue, the young players, because I've always believed if you're good enough, you're old enough. Throw them in, let them sink or let them swim. And I always felt that we had John Sillett, Peter Sillett, Reg Matthews, the goalkeeper, Peter Braybrook, people like that, who were holding the young players back, who were, in my opinion, were ready to make their debuts in the first team.
I mean, it was an amazing roller coaster for yourself there. You got relegated in 1962, went straight back up in 63, finished as high as fifth in 64. Got to the League Cup final in 65. I mean, it was an amazing time. But you filled that Chelsea team with people who've gone on to be legends of the club. I'm talking about people like Peter Benetti, Ron Harris, John Hollins, John Boyle, George Graham, Eddie McCready, Terry Venables, Bobby Tambling, who for many years was the record goal scorer. It was an amazing and very youthful team.
Yeah, Benetti, Shillito, McCready, Hollins, Hinton, Harris, Kukoc, Good, Venables, Graham, and Tambling.
An amazing team.
Yeah.
But of all the times at Chelsea, what do you think were your great achievements?
My great achievements was handling as players and professionals, people like Ron Harris and people like that. My biggest regret maybe would have been we couldn't hold on to Jimmy Greaves, the best goal scorer that I've ever seen. I felt that if we could have held on to him instead of transferring him to Inter Milan or AC Milan, we'd have won the championship two or three times.
The club got offered a lot of money, as I recall, nearly £100,000. And the player, if he wants to go, or was it different then? Why couldn't you hold on to him?
Well, of course, it was money again. I mean, I believe Jimmy, if my memory serves me correctly, he was on, I think he was on £18-20 a week at Stamford Bridge at the time. And he was offered £100 a week with the AC Milan. So, I mean, even in those days, it was a big step. Although I believe that Jimmy didn't particularly want it to go because he's a lovely East End lad, Jimmy, and he loved playing for Chelsea.
Tommy, as late as, you know, the summer of 1967, I'm saying it again, of course, a Spurs fan, you got beat by Spurs in the FA Cup final. Within 3 or 4 months, October, you've resigned. Why?
Well, first of all, I mean, even today, Danny, at Stamford Chelsea, every 18th of December every year, I receive from Harrods in London a £200 hamper from Chelsea Football Club. I don't know, because there's an ex-manager and they did a half-decent job for the club.
Wow.
And yet, I can ring up Man United and they charge me £88 for two tickets.
So you're making the point about the difference between the club. Why did you leave Chelsea then?
I left Chelsea because the chairman passed away, Mr. Mayers, God rest his soul. Because I could never... The new fellow who took over from him was the name of... wait to hear this one. Bill Pratt.
Really?
I fell out with him at the first board meeting. I said, Mr. Chairman, when I want your advice, I'll give it to you.
So that was never going to work, Tom, was it?
Not going to work. So I knew, and I always said that to a lot of people. Anything, God forbid, if anything ever happens to the chairman, I'm off.
In between the departure from Chelsea and your arrival as the Scottish manager, are about 3 years where you're really moving around a lot. Rotherham, QPR, Villa. Could you just not find the right job for yourself, Tommy?
Too impatient. One of my biggest weaknesses, and I've got a few, is that impatient. I love to be working. I hate to be idle. And when I lost a job, either club sacked me or I left on my own accord, I couldn't wait to get into another manager's job. And that was one of my, and still is to this day, to a certain extent probably, one of my biggest weaknesses.
In 1971, you became Scotland's national manager. Was that something you always had ambitions for, or was it just chance that you became the boss?
Actually, it happened quite by chance, actually. I was assistant manager to Terry Neill at Hull City.
Wow.
And I got a call one day from Hugh Nelson, who was the chairman of Arbroath Football Club in Scotland. I knew very well from my playing days, and he said, we're looking for a manager, would you be interested in the job? So I says, yes, I would, actually. So I flew up to Glasgow, had an interview, and almost immediately was appointed manager on £7,000 a year.
The princely sum of £7,000 a year.
For Scotland, that was quite a lot.
Absolutely. And one of the things that you did, I know, was that Bob Wilson, of course, was Arsenal's goalkeeper in their double-winning side of that year, 1971. Yeah. And he turned out he had Scottish parentage, and you got him into the Scotland squad. And you went about looking at the background of players. But this is a decade and a half before Jack Charlton started doing it in the Republic of Ireland. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair, I think, yeah. Bob was great. I mean, I'd seen him playing, obviously, for Arsenal. Great player, a great goalkeeper, a great pro. And of course, at the time, Scotland, we had a lad called Bobby Clark, who was form-wise in and out. And we were definitely desperate, as we are today, for a goalkeeper in Scotland. Never had one, are we?
I mean,
I think Jimmy Cowan and Morton was the best we've ever had, actually.
You had some great players in your team. That very first side that you picked, which was a Euro qualifier against Portugal at Hampden, included Bob Wilson, you mentioned there, Sandy Jardine, David Hay.
Archie Gemmell.
Archie Gemmell was in there, Billy Bremner, George Graham,
yeah.
Alex
Crockley. Peter Lorimer, Eddie Gray.
A really fantastic, actually a very, very good team. I mean, compared to now, where FIFA has sort of smoothed all these things out, how difficult was it to get the players to play? Would you have conflict with club managers, or was it just an accepted part of the game that you went off and played for your country?
No, I think the greatest honour you can get is to play for your country. I think. I captained my country, managed my country, and played for my country. It doesn't get any better than that. And I get paid for something that I love doing, actually. And I think that's got to be the best time of your life, actually. And, of course, when I went to manage Scotland, the players were already there, because I'd seen them in my English playing career and my managerial careers, more so.
You knew them.
I knew them.
Yeah.
And John O'Hare at Derby was another one. The only thing we lacked at the time with Jimmy Johnson of Glasgow Celtic, God rest his soul,
yeah.
Absolute little genius, David Hay. Yeah, I could go on and on and on. But there was nothing clever about it, Danny. They were there. It was just a case of putting them in the team. Dennis Law, a lot of people said he was past his best. It's a matter of opinion. Great player for me for Scotland when I played with Dennis for Scotland. And then, of course, I become manager. I said, well, they can even maybe do as a short spell or an hour during a game rather than an hour and a half. But he was a winner and a tremendous player.
You go on, and the Scotland team is doing fine. And in the middle of qualification for the 1974 World Cup, there comes a phone call that changes your life, I guess. Manchester United turn up. You must have been, or maybe not, how conflicted were you about carrying on with a promising Scotland team or joining one of the biggest clubs in England?
Very difficult. I remember how it all came about was I was down at Man United, were playing Crystal Palace, who Crystal Palace beat them 5-1 that day at Selhurst Park. And I went down to watch a left back playing for Crystal Palace, who didn't turn out as good as we thought he might be. And at half-time, I was approached by Sir Matt Wisby, God rest his soul, saying he'd like to speak to him in the boardroom after the game with the chairman, Louis Edwards. After the game, they got hammered 5-1. After the game, into the boardroom, they said, how do you fancy managing Manchester United? I said, but you've got a manager, Frank O'Farrell, who, ironically enough, is godfather to one of my sons.
Wow.
And we played together, Frank and I, at Preston North End for about quite a long time. Great pro, lovely man, Frank. And I went over to Frank. I said, I've just been approached to take over at Man United, your job. What will I do? He says, take it. He says, if you don't take it, someone else will take it.
So he must have known his days were numbered.
Oh, yeah, he did, actually. And the following Wednesday, he was sacked. And I flew down to, I had to get permission from Willie Allen, who was the secretary at the Scottish Football Association. United had gone about it the right way in approaching the secretary for permission to speak to me, although really I'd been tapped up at Selhurst Park. So I went down to Mortram Hall on the Thursday morning and was appointed the manager on £15,000 a year.
Tommy, you find Manchester United, I mean, when you went to Chelsea, you found a team full of old players who needed to be upgraded and you got relegated before you could do that.
Yeah.
At Manchester United, ironically, you find almost an identical situation. But the difference is, Tommy, that the players that are now coming to the end of their careers at Manchester United are legends, not just of Manchester United, but of the game in this country. Mm. The Charltons, the Laws, the Bess.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you approach the job?
Well, similar to what I did at Chelsea, I knew, and I will not mean disrespectful here, there was a lot of dead wood at Old Trafford at the time. Bobby Charlton made it very easy for me because he was one of the ones who would have gone. And he asked me for permission to speak to Sir Martin, the chairman, Mr. Edwards, which I gave him, obviously. And he told him that he was finishing at the end of that year. And, of course, I got rid of one or two players, Tony Dunn and people like that, gave Dennis a free transfer, who I thought, with the greatest respect, wonderful player, he passed his sell by there. A lot of players are, and it's not a nice thing to see or do. It happens to us all. And, of course, the supporters find it a hard tablet to swallow.
Tommy, I mean, you know, you did what you had to do, and the team was eventually relegated.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this question. How could a team go from being champions of Europe in 1968 to relegated within 5 years?
Obviously, very easily. I think it was due to the fact that, with the greatest respect to Sir Mart, they kept a lot of the players past their sell by date, and they couldn't do the job any longer. The pinnacle of their career was winning the European Cup, of course.
And famously, United went down in 73-74. I mean, hard to remember that was in the days when even big clubs in the 1970s, both Manchester United and Tottenham, both found themselves relegated at various times. Talk to me about the season you went down. What did you feel about that? And of course, the famously Dennis Law scored that goal that contributed to United's relegation that day.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I felt awful. I mean, I thought I might have got the sack. That was one of the things that crossed my mind. A big club, massive club at Man United. Although I wasn't responsible for the players that were there when I took over. I think that's something that worked in my favour. When I started to bring one or two in and let one or two go, that didn't go down too well with Sir Mark, God rest his soul. And the other members of the board didn't count. They didn't matter. I mean, they had no idea. They thought they didn't know a semi-final from a centre-half. But Sir Matt knew the game, and he was nice and he was helpful, and he disagreed with a lot of things I said and did. But that's fair enough. That's his opinion, and that's my opinion.
How difficult was it to run Manchester United with Matt Busby still at the club?
Well, I think that's the thing I hope Alec Ferguson doesn't do. He's an incredible manager. He's done an incredible job. I hope he doesn't, when he decides to call it a day, he doesn't move upstairs into the boardroom. Because that'll be the worst thing. Because that was one of the worst things, I think, with the greatest respect, that Sir Mark Busby did.
So you find yourself with a famous day going down, the hundreds of thousands of kids on the pitch as United make their way down. And you don't get the sack. So in the next part of the show, Tommy, we'll be looking at the re-emergence of Manchester United as a major force in English football under your tutelage, including promotion back to the top flight, the FA Cup disappointment of 1976, followed by glory in 1977, when you stopped Liverpool doing the treble, something for which every Manchester United fan still thanks you to this day, plus your controversial sacking from that club. You're listening to My Sporting Life on TalkSport. Tonight's guest is the former Manchester United manager, Tommy Docherty. I'm Danny Kelly, this is TalkSport, and you're listening to a special edition of My Sporting Life, featuring former Chelsea, Manchester United and Scotland manager Tommy Docherty. Now, we've already heard about Manchester United's shocking relegation in 1974, and although he feared for his job, the club stuck with him. I asked him if the club's relegation was actually a kind of blessing in disguise.
No, people say that to me, but I disagree with it. I mean, it's the most horrible tab to have against your name as a coach and as a manager to say, you know, more or less admit that it was a good thing that we went down. No, I don't think so at all, actually. I think it was dreadful that we went down.
Okay, so the following year, though, you bounced straight back up, which is, of course, the great trick in these things, if you can do it. Won the second division title in 1975, finishing 3 points clear of Aston Villa. And the team bounced straight up into the higher level. Instead, the following year, you're third back in the first division, just 4 points behind the champions Liverpool. Who had you brought in, and how had you transformed the team, Tommy?
Well, I kept most of the, I would say, the fellas that I felt could continue to do a job for us for a couple of years to stabilise us a little bit after going down. People like Lou McCarry was a great signing for us.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Coppell, fantastic signing for us from Tranmere, 25,000 quid.
Wow.
Gordon Hill from Charlton for, I think it was £40,000. Martin Buck and I recommended them to Frank O'Farrell when I was Scottish team manager. He was a great signing for Frank. Alec Forsyth, the fullback. But players like Sammy McElroy, who were injured at the time, they got fit again. And there was him and Jimmy Nicol, a big lad called Jim Holton, 6'2", eyes of blue. Big Jim Holton's after you.
Yeah.
players like that.
My memories of that team, Tommy, are that with Coppell wide right, Gordon Hill wide left, the likes of
Stuart Pearson,
Lou McCurry, that it was a team that was, it couldn't go, it could only do one thing. It was designed to go forward.
Yeah,
and in game after game after game, Man United might concede a goal, but they overwhelmed the opposition with the amount of attacking they did.
Yeah, and little David McCreary and Jimmy Nicol were great players for me as well, who have come up through the youth ranks. The great thing about us, Bill Nicholson paid us a wonderful compliment. He says, the great thing about your team, Tommy, you don't know whether they're winning 3-0 or losing 3-0.
They play the same way.
They play the same way.
And the momentum. I'm repeating myself really, but Coppell and Hill out wide.
Brilliant.
We hadn't in English football seen two such excellent wide players, wingers as you would call them, in the same team for a long time, and it tore two teams to pieces on good days.
Yeah, and Pearson and Jimmy Greenough were fantastic, and Brian Greenough was already there, of course, But they were great. I used to love Friday nights. We took them away before the games, even at home. And I thought, tomorrow we're playing. I love watching us playing. Because Coppell and Hill were just an absolute delight to watch.
That must be one of the nicest feelings you can have in professional sport when you're looking forward to watching your own team play.
Yeah, and I love wingers. I was brought up with wingers at Preston and Arsenal, And Coppell and Hill were as good as you got.
There is some disappointment before we get to the major triumph. In 76, you're third, but also reached the FA Cup final. It's one of those cup finals everyone remembers because Manchester United would have been pretty firm favourites.
Very much so.
And, of course, Southampton were in the second division. And Bobby Stokes, a player whose name is forever now associated with that one match.
That offside goal we keep talking about every time I see big Laurie McManamy. I say, that was really offside, Laurie.
So, tell me how the day went for you and what your memories are of the game leading up to that winner 7 minutes from the end from Bobby Stokes.
Well, we went down on the Wednesday to the hotel in London and we just took it easy and just chilled out a little bit. And we felt, not smug or overconfident, we just felt if Southampton play the best that they can and we play the best that we can, we'll win. And we didn't. And on the day, we were beaten by the better side, I might add. And you know something about football? Laurie McManamy is a lovely big man.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice. It wasn't nice to get beat. But if you're going to get beat, you don't mind being beat when it's a nice person that beats you. And Southampton Football Club were always a lovely, with Ted Bates and people like that. They were always a nice club to go to, and you were welcome and... Sometimes you get a good hiding and a cup of tea, but sometimes you get nothing at all. But it was nice to get beat with nice people, if you know what I mean.
United now have gone a long time since winning the European Cup, and I think they hadn't won a trophy then for nine years, or certainly 8 years. So the disappointment was there. The following year, you do something about it. You finish sixth in the league, mm-hmm. Have another great run in the FA Cup, and the 1977 FA Cup final is one that, again, people who are of a certain age absolutely remember. Tell me about the run-up to that FA Cup and how you went into a game against a Liverpool side, in contrast to Southampton, where you were the favourites. Liverpool were going for the league, the FA Cup, and the European Cup double.
Yeah.
Treble, what am I talking about? Three trophies,
actually.
Treble,
yeah. It's a funny thing about the FA Cup, Danny. I think if your name is on the FA Cup, you'll win it. I'm a great believer in that. And I felt that day, it wasn't a particularly good match. And I felt, against Southampton, I thought I'd mortgage the house, it will beat them. And of course, we know the way it went. And then again, Liverpool, I thought, this is my third cup final. Will it be third time lucky or won't it? And as it turned out, it was third time lucky. And although it was nice to beat Liverpool, who I've got great respect for as a club, and Shanks is a big mate of mine, God rest his soul, and Bob Paisley and Joe Fagan, lovely people. And, you know, it was nice to not stop them from doing the treble, but it was nice to beat them and win the FA Cup.
Yet within a month of that great triumph, Tommy, because of matters off the pitch, you have been sacked by Manchester United. Do you want to go through the events that led to that happening?
Yeah, it didn't bother me at all.
Well, fire away then.
Right.
It had become public knowledge that you were having what would in those days was described as an extramarital affair with the wife of one of the other people who worked at Manchester United. And in these days, I'm not sure that people would have batted an eyelid, but in those days, people took a very dim view of it.
Well, excuse me. Well, I mean, it's one of those situations where my marital side was not good at all.
Mm-hmm.
Through no fault of my ex-wife, God rest her soul,
yes,
who was a nice person. Just that the marriage had sort of petered out, so to speak, for the want of a better word. And I only occasionally saw Mary when she came to a function with her husband, Laurie.
This is Mary Brown.
Laurie Brown, who was the physio at Man United.
Right.
And she came to one or two functions, not a lot. And we got chatting, as you do, and we got to know each other. And then things just got, not once they got out of hand, but we both saw, we had a lot in common with each other. And I asked her out once or twice, and she turned it down. And then asked her another few times, she said okay, and we went out and saw each other. But it wasn't, no one knew about it. Well, as far as we were concerned, no one knew about it. Until I had told the board I was due to sign a new contract, and I told the board before I'd signed it what was happening or what was going on. And that's when it started to roll on a little bit.
So you took upon yourself to tell the board what was happening, and what was their reaction?
Well, it wasn't good at all, actually, because I was due to sign this contract, a new contract, and I told them, I said, look, I can't sign a new contract because this is the situation between my marital problem, Agnes, my ex-wife, and Mary and I. And, well, I mean, you could see their faces. I mean, they couldn't believe it, like, and Samat was obviously very, very upset about it. And the rest of the board, I think in fairness to the rest of the board, they went along with Sir Matt, God rest his soul, and they decided in a very short space of time that we couldn't carry on like that, and I had to leave the club.
What did you feel about that at the time?
I felt it was a very difficult situation for the club, even at that time, but I didn't feel that it warranted the sack. I thought I should have been judged on my ability as a coach or as a manager. But I think there was a lot of intrigue within the club. There was friends of the board who, I used to call them the junior board, who stirred up any problems. I think the director's wives had a bit of a say in it as well. They thought it wasn't a good thing. This is what I can gather from inside the club since I left. And they decided that they call it a day, and I was called into a board meeting, and I was told that I'd been relieved of my services.
I should make the point to the listeners that this was no fling, that yourself and Mary are still very much together.
Oh, lovely bit. She's the best thing that's ever happened to me, actually. She is a star.
And so when I ask you the question if you've had any regrets about what happened, your answer will probably be no.
I should have done it sooner. But Mary and I mean, she is... I can't find words to explain how I feel about her and what she means to me.
Yeah, you've been listening to a special My Sporting Life with Tommy Docherty, and a poignant moment to end the whole thing with Tommy's beautiful tribute to his wife, Mary. I'm Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.